minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, opt in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
And it is Saturday, the 28th of March in the glorious future year of 2026. And I am coming to you from Munich, capital of the Free State of Bavaria in southern Germany, where, well, I saw a weather forecast yesterday which was prognosticating heavy snow beginning this evening and continuing into Monday with blizzard conditions. My own personal observation as of this moment is not showing this happening, and I've seen some other forecasts that don't indicate quite that degree of unpleasantness for the end of March, beginning of April, but I had gone down to the Frauenkirche, the Dom zu unserer liebe Frau, the co-cathedral, to see what the schedule was for services. Of course, we have Palm Sunday, and then there'll be the typical Passiontide services after that, right? Anyway, generally speaking, there's a procession for Palm Sunday, and the note was there would be a procession at 10 a.m., weather permitting. And so we shall see. I thought I might go down and join in it, but if it's going to be raining, snowing, cold generally, I'm not going to bother. Likewise, the other disincentivizing fact is that I've got to do a time change tonight. You know that I don't approve of that kind of thing, but they're changing the clocks tonight, so 10 o'clock tomorrow morning will be equivalent to 9 o'clock this morning plus 24 hours. We're going from UTC plus 1 to UTC plus 2 European summer time. As I say, you know I don't approve of that kind of thing. So what has been going on that's worth talking about? Well, of course, NASA's Artemis II is back out at the pad at Launch Complex 39, Kennedy Space Center, Cape Canaveral, Florida. And they are doing the countdown for a proposed April 1st launch, launching in that April 1st window. And we'll see if it happens or not. They might do it. What happens if they do? I don't know. I don't think anyone really knows. That's sort of the thing. When you haven't done something since 1972, because make no mistake, this will be, if it comes off, this will be the first U.S. or anyone else's manned mission beyond lower Earth orbit since 1972. That's concerning, I think, for a person of my bent. A, that we should have been doing more of this all along, and B, you can only get so ambitious when most of the people who knew how to do this stuff are retired or in fact dead. There have been some interesting announcements, including, oh yes, we're going to have a Mars mission for 2028 with nuclear propulsion or something of that kind. And my comment on it is, look, I've recently spoken to the guy who's in charge of this kind of thing at NASA. And from what I could say about all of it, I think that the biggest obstacle is lack of shop capacity. Back when NASA and the Atomic Energy Commission were testing the Kiwi and Phoebus series of nuclear rocket engines, you know, they had shops that were dedicated to fabricating weird kinds of nuclear reactor fuel and that sort of thing. And the U.S. doesn't really have that at the moment. We sort of let that industry die. So any claims that the U.S. is going to do anything with space reactors by 2028, I think are beyond the scope of what we can reasonably say right now. So, closer to home, there was a whale that got stranded on a sandbar in the Baltic earlier in the week, and several people, there was quite a bit of effort expended to get it off. It got off the sandbar yesterday, and according to reports, has managed to strand itself on another sandbar today. I think at this point, we just sort of have to give up and say, yes, this is now a land whale. It's not going nowhere. Let's see. In Kirchheim, not terribly far from here, you know, you hear about supply chain attacks nowadays. People are talking about malicious insertion of things into computer code. So that most recently there was a thing where it was not the code itself, but the NPM packaging, thanks to somebody using a LLM-based tool to triage incoming requests and bug reports and things like that. Somebody created a report which caused the tool to then insert a line into the NPM, which basically meant that anybody who installed or updated the software package would get their whole system taken over by something called OpenClaw, which, you know, again, only makes me think the claw chooses who will stay and who will go. If you remember the movie Toy Story, brilliant movie. Anyway, where were we at? So yeah, that's the sort of thing you think of these days when people say supply chain attacks. But no, in the nearby village of Kirchheim, not terribly far from Munich, Thursday morning, 10 heavily armed men burst into a logistics center and stole a bunch of parcels. And so I'm interested to know, you know, did they get information saying that there was going to be a parcel of diamonds passing through there or something? Because there's a lot of very high-value stuff which is just sent by registered mail, ordinary letter mail, even in some cases. And so if they had that advance information, they might have tried to do that. It is one of the consequences. I mean, generally speaking, having parcels be trackable is good, but if somebody slips you the tracking number of a parcel that they know contains very, very valuable items, then you could potentially steal it out of the parcel delivery chain. Although, honestly, I'd be surprised at the bursting into a parcel center rather than simply hijacking the truck it was on. Let's see, I went downtown to Manufactum and I did use their Atoma punch to punch covers that I had already printed up but not perforated for the Man and Atom briefing book. And then I did buy some of the 24 millimeter diameter rings. They call them rings, they're not rings, obviously, they're discs with broad rims. And I think this may be the way that I bind the Euro version of the Man and Atom briefing book from now on. That could be a really good option, I believe. Although those rings are not cheap. And hold on a moment while I actually go grab my little notebook that I was writing all this stuff down in. You know, I am so smart. I write everything down in a little notebook and then don't actually carry it with me. Not sure what I'm doing with my life, you know? So Tobe is not the only one who sometimes gets lost in the middle of a show. Anyway, that's not hugely important right now. But what is hugely important? Well, let's talk about South Australia for a moment. Because there's a certain sect of people, and it may actually only be one person, it's always hard to tell. Certain sort of people on Mastodon. Certain sort of people on Mastodon who, which of course is pretty much the only internet social media that I will go within a mile of, and even then, I typically will be on for like a week or two at a time and then off for 6 weeks. This is very common. Anyhow, forget that. Who keep holding up South Australia as a model for the world. Now, of course, if you're like me, when you hear South Australia, what you immediately think of is a sea shanty. In South Australia I was born, heave away, haul away in South Australia, round Cape Horn, and we're bound for South Australia. Haul away, your ruler king, heave away, haul away, haul away, you'll hear me sing, and we're bound for South Australia. Yeah, that's your monthly ration of my singing, or possibly even 6 months' worth. I don't usually sing on the show, but it does happen every few months. But where was I? Well, you see, people will tell you, or again, it may just be the one person, people will tell you that South Australia has decarbonized its electrical system using renewables, and that they know, you know, they only have one power line tying them to the rest of Australia, and that everything works just fine, and that South Australia is a model for the world. Well, I have my doubts. And let me tell you about my doubts, right? Because doubt number one has to do with the fact that South Australia is, by any measure, not very populous. Right? It's got a low population density. So there's lots and lots of land for things like wind and solar installations. Item two, South Australia is very, very sunny. Like, really sunny. Far sunnier than most places in the world. Item three, South Australia is not very heavily industrialized, although it may be said that they do have an aluminum smelter, apparently, and they have been able to keep it running through some fairly significant system disturbances, which is certainly to their credit. Point four, however, is how much did that cost? Because, of course, Australia is in the wealthiest tier of countries, so solutions which are suitable for Australia might not be affordable for some other places, many other places, the kinds of places where most people in the world live, which are not anything like as sunny, which are in many cases more thickly populated, places which are more heavily industrialized or trying to get that way, right? So I'm not convinced that anything that is said to work for South Australia is necessarily a model for the rest of the world, but here's the real killer, folks. South Australia's primary energy supply, right? If you break down their primary energy supply and you say, you know, how is energy supplied in South Australia? You're going to find that pretty much the biggest line item is not electricity.